This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Hamish McDonald, filling in for Richard Feidler for the next little while Richard is away writing his new book. Osher Ginsberg hosts some of Australia's most popular radio and television programs. You probably know him as the guy at the rose ceremonies in The Bachelor, and the happy dude with the big smile and the even bigger hair hosting Australian Idol. He grew up as Andrew in the suburbs, first of Adelaide and then Brisbane, and originally wanted to be on stage as a musician. For all of his success today, it has been a difficult journey. In 2014, a series of setbacks saw Osher wandering the streets of Venice Beach in LA, convinced the world was coming to an end. Soon after, he began having hallucinations. Osher now talks pretty openly about his struggles with addiction, mental health, and body image. And just a note for you, some aspects of Osher's story could be troubling for you. Osher, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great honour to be here on this show that I one day want to grow up to host.
You cycled in this morning. How was that?
It was great. I love riding my bicycle whenever I can. I think it's super important. It's very helpful for my head to get exercise in every day. And if I can get some cycling in between what I've got to do, I try to do it wherever I possibly can. Because it's also a great way to see the city and a great way. Because if you ride to work, you can eat anything you want. So you don't have to go to gym if you ride to work. It's great. But I went to gym this morning anyway.
Purely pragmatic then. Let's go back to the start. Where did you grow up?
The part I can't remember was in London, but the part I start to remember was in Adelaide, in the lovely inner northern suburbs of Adelaide, which was a very quiet, very peaceful part of Australia at the time, with a very dark history that I didn't realise until quite later when I moved back there. But that was all the sandpit stuff. And then the primary school stuff did start there, but it was mostly Brisbane, the western suburbs. They're now inner western, but the outer western suburbs of Brisbane.
How did your parents end up in Australia?
Oh, right. So after the Second World War, during the Second World War, my mum fled with the retreating German army out of Lithuania because the Russians had come in 1941 and then the Germans fought them back. And then when the Russians were, we know what the Germans did, right? But when the Russians are coming back, they went, oh, we don't want that again. Like, you can just imagine how it would have been horrible. Anyway, so they spent a couple of years on the road and they ended up in a refugee camp in Berlin and then, not in Berlin, in Bad Edberg, which was in some part of Germany. It ended up being the American sector. They ended up getting on a boat that brought them down to Australia and they lived, they were displaced persons then. We called them what they were. They were persons who were displaced. They weren't refugees. I think a label can do a lot for the status of a person. And actually the front page of, I think it was the Adelaide Advertiser, two doctors arrived because both my grandparents were doctors. I couldn't believe that the city was getting two more doctors. You know, they obviously made them go back and do their medical degrees again because they didn't trust them anyway. So years later, when my mum was finishing her medical degree, the best education was in the UK. So she went there and the Russians had come into Czechoslovakia after World War II and were cracking down pretty hard, and then the Prague Spring happened, and it was actually 50 years ago last week that my father escaped from Prague and ended up in Vienna and then hitchhiked his way across Europe to London. And so here he's 24 years old, no longer has a country he can't go back to. Again, you know, he's living in London, I believe he slept in someone's hallway. And he was a doctor as well. They both happened to have jobs at a hospital in Stoke-on-Trent, and they met at a party, and that was it. My big brother came along, I came along, and then by that point, the grandfather that had brought the family to Australia was dying of cancer, and back then you just moved. So they came down to Adelaide initially for a year, but they ended up staying, and that's it. That's how we came back.
How important was it for your dad sourcing obscure European cured meats once here in Australia?
Look, nowadays you can roll down the street, roll down the aisle in Coles in, you know, suburban Rockhampton and find yourself some excellent smoked sausage, okay, because I've seen it, right? But back then, Dad was like, what? Like, he comes to this country at the bottom end of Australia, at the other end of the world. It's a weird town on the edge of a desert. And all he wants is salami that tastes like home. He doesn't know what pie is. The food's weird. The birds are weird. The place is different. So he felt like he finds the one place in all of Adelaide that's, you know, and he's, I think one day he was on the beach. I think we might've been at Henley Beach, and he heard some guys talking and they were Czech. And he's like, oh my God, are you Czech too? You know, they just couldn't believe that they'd found each other. And this, you know, back then it's like the other end of the planet. And turns out one of them had a smokehouse in his backyard.
He did gold.
Jackpot. Like, it's like the home brew of, you know, it's like, brilliant. Give me that, you know, give me that fish that's been sitting in there for 6 weeks. I want some. And so, yeah, Dad started procuring these really super stinky things. And as kids, we, you know, would get sent to school, and anyone who's got, you know, European or, you know, parents that aren't Anglo will know what it is to be sent to school with what your parents think is food. And you, your schoolmates are like, what is that? No one wants to swap peanut butter for liverwurst and, you know, a cup of borscht.
Did you like the stuff?
It's all I knew. It was food. You know, that's all I knew. It was only years later when I stopped eating meat that I was like, oh, actually, this is kind of better.
Your grandmother lived with you,
yeah,
as well. What sort of character was she?
She had you know, difficult time, and I understand. You know, I can't even imagine what it's like to be living in a city that's invaded and occupied, and you know, then just trying to. She had a daughter by then, and then having to escape, and then my dad's father, who was a political journalist for the newspaper there in Prague, had to, the Associated Press actually smuggled them out because, oh, the Nazis are occupying and you're Jewish, we've got to get you out of here. So, you know, underwent all kinds of trauma, and that, you know, I'm sure that played out later in her life. But, you know, she was the, you know, pretty much the caricature of the European grandma who lived with us. She was our Bobby, and it was, eat, why you not eat, or you don't like me because you're not eating. It was that.
And what sort of influence was she, though, on your parents, on you guys?
I think it was quite difficult. It was difficult. I'm sure anyone that's had this, you know, will relate, you know, when there's a parent that lives, just one parent that lives with a couple, the opportunity for sides to be taken can happen pretty quickly. And particularly when there's another language that can be spoken between two of them exclusively. And yeah, so there was a bit of that, but she eventually moved out. I think Mum saw it was like, well, you're going to have to go. So she moved out.
There was a minor earthquake in Adelaide,
yeah,
during your childhood. Yeah. Why does that particular event stand out in your memory?
Oh, because I was with my dad. We had a cellar in Adelaide. I remember being down there and all these bottles started tinkling together and I couldn't quite believe it. Then we ran upstairs and all the glasses and the plates and everything were rattling. And my dad was like, wow, it's an earthquake. And I ran out to the driveway and I saw there was a big crack had appeared in our driveway. And I didn't know what earthquakes were, but in the course of all the tinkling, Dad explained, you know, he's a doctor. So he's like, oh, the tectonic plates and blah, blah, blah. He gives me the whole explanation. So suddenly there's this gigantic power way greater than me that has way more control over all of us that none of us can do anything to influence. And this idea that we're at the mercy of something we can't control really kind of hit me. Also, the idea that I now believe that there was a fissure to the center of the earth that was now in our driveway. I've sent a few Lego men down to explore it, but they never came back. So as far as I'm concerned, there was.
you got that far in your thinking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, our folks were both academics, you know, they're both doctors and were very, very much like, they never spoke to us in baby talk. And I only know this because I watched them raise my younger brothers. They never spoke to them in baby talk. They only ever spoke to us with full sentences, using proper words, and made us pronounce words properly and asked us, you know, questions that required thinking. And so from early on, we were encouraged to be curious about the world and to think, you know, ask bigger questions and, you know, be observant and trying to figure out how things got the way they are. And that's helped me in some ways, but sometimes it can spin a bit out of control and I can get a bit too wide with my lens and start to take in a bit too much. But yeah, I don't know how, you know, I just kind of always envied other kids who just went, oh yeah.
Pretty early on, you made a connection between pain and fear and food.
Yes.
How did that happen?
I started experiencing, I think I was about 5 when it happened, when I started experiencing ruminating anxiety that I felt in my body. And at 5, as far as I can remember, and I've thought pretty hard when I wrote the book, no big trauma had happened. There'd been a, you know, that happened later. But so that kind of goes to show that you kind of come out a certain way. You get born with a certain amount of wiring, you know, from as far as I can gather and what my doctors have told me, it's about 50-50. You know, this is the source code you've been given, and then you kind of add operating systems on top of that, depending on what happened to you in your life. Luckily, as adults, we can reinstall different adult operating systems, but the source code is kind of harder to change. So having this ruminating anxiety about the age of five, it made my stomach hurt really, you know, it was quite painful in my stomach. And I discovered that if I put food in there, it made that feeling go away. And so that kind of started the compulsive eating and, you know, that then started feeling ashamed about my body. And then that started, you know, body dysmorphia and stuff like that. So I was in Weight Watchers when I was eight. I remember going.
Eight years old.
I was in Weight Watchers, and it wasn't until very much later, I was about when I was 36 and I got sober, and I'm sitting in these fellowship meetings going, oh, this is just Weight Watchers, just without the scale. Oh, okay.
Were there many kids at Weight Watchers?
No, it was me and my mum and a lot of other women her age and one or two blokes. And so that really just goes to show what kind of an absolute powerhouse my mum was and how just committed she was to finding solutions that were perhaps unconventional to what was going on and just taking radical steps to, okay, well, let's just sort this out. You know, I guess anyone that's lived as, you know, on the road as a displaced person would just be like, okay, that's a problem. We can't do anything about that. Let's find a solution. This is what's going to happen rather, you know. And I just can't thank her enough for seeing that I needed that. And she came with me.
How did you find that experience? Did it work?
It was great. We dropped heaps of weight. I felt really good. But it's for me, it was an unsustainable thing, 'cause I don't know, I'm eight, you know, I didn't really know how to change my eating habits or why I was eating the way I was eating. I didn't know that I was eating at that point. I didn't know that I was eating to put things in my body to make my body feel different. So it wasn't long before I was back and kind of blitzed through that from a way in, to be honest.
When you're 12 years old, how did things change in the family dynamic?
So my folks had tried super hard to keep it together. My grandmother had moved out by that point, and it was initially quite peaceful, but then it started to devolve, unfortunately. And, you know, we're not the first family where mum and dad just go, you know what, it's probably going to be better if we're apart. And I heard that the other day. A mate of mine said to me because we were talking, I got divorced later in life. He said to me that the greatest advice ever given to him was, he was trying to say someone, oh, me and my wife are trying, you know, we don't want to get divorced because of the kids. And the guy said, no, mate, you got it all wrong. You get divorced for the kids. You get divorced to give them the peace. And I saw that, you know, when my own parents split up, there was just, it's just a relief. You know, we all could then just kind of have without that constant, I guess, you know, maelstrom of energy going on in the house, we were all able to have a, you know, redefine our relationships in a kind of much calmer way, which is actually quite nice.
So you remember at 12 thinking, yeah, this is the right thing.
Well, you know, when we get stuck in patterns of behavior, and I know this from, you know, I've been in a number of long-term relationships, romantic relationships, and you get stuck in patterns of behavior to the point where you can probably by rote recite exactly the argument you're about to have. And you're like, okay, this is no longer me making a choice. I'm now just living out a pattern that I'm not making a choice of. I need to do something to interrupt this pattern if I want to have a different outcome, because every time we do this, it's just going to degrade.
And what was going on for you at that time at school? Because I know you described yourself as the chubby kid, but you weren't really hiding in the corner doing nothing.
No, at that point, I think I just started high school, and I went to, at the time in Brisbane, you know, the best high school we could go to. It wasn't a state school. My parents valued education very, very highly. Like, you know, most immigrant families are like, education, that's the key for everything, which it is. And so we went to this school that was all boys, and they were the sons of the landed gentry. They were the sons of the cotton and cattle and wheat barons of Queensland, and, you know, their lawyers. And we were the kids of the of the doctors, I guess. And so we were able to afford to go there. So I guess we were a part of that in a way. But yeah, it was an all boys rugby school and I didn't play rugby. So it was not great to be the fat kid in the corner at PE, because physicality and physical, you know, exercise and stuff like that had always been so terrifying me, because I was so ashamed of my body. So, you know, there was nothing more horrifying than swim at PE. It was just the worst. Because I knew there would be teasing and bullying, and there was, and it was never any fun. So by the time grade 11 came around, and PE was no longer compulsory, it was just, oh, finally. I was so happy.
Can you remember what you were thinking in those PE lessons, you know, when you're there putting on the Speedos or whatever it is?
Oh, just don't look at me, don't look at me, don't look at me, you know, because when they looked at me, my body was something to be ridiculed. And, you know, I guess back then it was a little different with, you know, how kids were to each other and the ways that, you know, teachers may have dealt with that sort of stuff between kids. And
what was the approach of teachers?
Oh, just, you know, I think they just come in and blow a whistle, cut it out. That was about it. You know, that was about it. But, yeah, I'd hide in the corner with my back to the crowd and get changed and then kind of, you know, walk out on the pool deck with my hands in front of me. I was just so ashamed of my own body. You know, I was like 13, 14 years old. It was hard. It was so hard.
How important was it then for you to find your way into music, into bands, into performance?
Well, the thing about that, and that started actually quite young. I was about 9 when that started. I remember walking out on stage in a primary school play, actually, like a Friday assembly that we would have. And I walked out on stage, and that ruminating anxiety that I described earlier was just kind of with me always. But when I stood on stage, it all went away. You know, it would sort of just circle above me like a wedge-tailed eagle, just waiting for the right trigger and then just descend and just start plowing it in my guts. But when I was on stage, I was the one in control, all right? And that became what I started to chase, is to be on stage. If you're going to think something about me, at least I'll have some control of what you're going to think about me, which is pretty intense stuff for a 9-year-old, right? But that's, I started to chase that. I started to chase that coping mechanism. And so being on stage, playing music, being in that moment was the thing that gave respite to that constant circling of fear. And yeah, it's what it ended up becoming my career.
Did it change the dynamics for you at school? Did you become popular because of that stuff?
Not essentially.
It was just a temporary.
It set you aside. You know, you were there was the boys in the, you know, in the first whatever, cricket, rowing, footy, whatever. And those were the ones in the corner who, you know, were figuring out weird riffs from the radio on their guitars. And every now and again, they're like, you know, that would play at an assembly and we would have to clap. But, you know, we had that.
How did you end up with your first job as a roadie?
So I was 17 when I started working as a roadie, which is basically that's a job that involves lifting the heavy equipment that is required so that a band can play in a pub, speakers, lights, guitar cases, all that kind of stuff. I was 17 years old. It was the very day that I didn't see my name in the paper as getting into university. And there's no reason my name should have been in the paper, because I did not get the high school marks required.
But your mates' names were.
They all were, yeah, yeah. So again, you know, it was quite clear that I went and saw my friends' names there, but my name wasn't there. And that day I was like, well, what do I do now? And I got a call from one of my friends at school and said, oh, my cousin, her band, they need a lighting guy. You want to do it? Yes, I do. And so I started learning how to be a lighting guy for $40 cash a night, you know. So I did that for 3 years. It was a couple of different bands. I did that for 3 years. I got 2 hernias and hearing damage out of it, but I learned a lot.
Did you like it?
I liked the regimented part of it. I liked that we, you know, the pub was empty at 1 p.m. when we loaded in. The pub was empty again at 3 a.m. when we loaded out, but we built this whole thing together. The band turned up, got on stage, plugged in, rocked out, plugged, unplugged, turned off, packed it all down, got back in the truck, and then we drove to Tamworth or Lismore or wherever we were going. And, yeah, I kind of liked that. You know, I liked that. I was 10 years younger than the youngest guy in the band. And so I'm working with these men, particularly the second band I work with. I'm working with these men who, you know, showed me the ways of of living on the road.
What happens on tour?
Well, yeah, it was, I liked the idea of that, you know, we were this band of pirates that were roaming the, the Bruce Highway, north of Brisbane, you know, playing five sets of covers a night.
So how did you go from that to then getting your first job in radio?
Well, working for other people's bands gave me an idea, because I always played music, gave me an idea of what I knew what the gig was and what it was to play in a band. But then I remembered, I like being on stage. That's what I wanted. I want to be on stage. So an extraordinary move. My school counselor, because my younger brothers were still at the same school, my school counselor, even though I'd graduated high school, she called me up one day and she goes, "You still doing that roadie job?" Yeah. She goes, "Well, come in. I've got to talk to you about something." And she directed me towards this TAFE course in contemporary music. And so I auditioned and I got in. They only took, 15 people out of 1,500 or something like that. So I was pretty excited by that. And then I got back on stage. I was like, "Oh, that's right. This is what I do. Yeah. And I got in a band and I was playing in like an original band, which means, we were unemployed. But I was playing in a band around Brisbane. But I just kind of knew that there was something more. I knew there was something more to do. And I knew I wanted to work in the music industry. And so, but I didn't really want to be a roadie anymore. So I hand wrote letters to all the radio stations in Brisbane saying, "Look, this is me. This is what I do. I'll do anything just to be around. I'm happy just come an intern. Like, whatever you need, let me do it." One of the bar managers that had met me in the very first band I roadied with when I was 17 was now working as promotions director at a radio station in Brisbane. And he recognized my face because I put a photo in there. And he goes, "I know that guy, because I used to see this guy." And he would unlock the loading dock for us and I would, be friendly with him. So this is a guy I'd met 3 years before. I said, "I know that guy, get him in." And I got a job for the, big commercial FM station in Brisbane, giving out icy cans of soft drink and that was my job. And once I got in that door, I just worked and worked and worked.
Once you got through that door, the trajectory was incredible. I mean, you really moved very quickly through the radio industry into television.
Yeah.
What had happened? What did you find?
I found something that I was good at. I had learned enough about speaking, about projecting who I am on stage, being able to, I learned later on a way to describe it. I got very good at communicating a message directly to people, particularly directly into their hearts. And there was something that they all heard in me. They went, "Oh yeah, he's a bit raw, but he's got it." And I would work 6-7 days a week, and it was like 5-6 weeks. I just wouldn't stop. And so, okay, he wants it. I was so hungry, and because this was the first thing I'd ever actually been good at, and people were like, "Yeah, you're good at this. You should do it." And I worked so hard, Hamish, and I've always worked that hard when I can, because that's what it takes. That's what it's always taken, is to work that hard, and that hard work doesn't stop. As soon as I get out of here, I've got a podcast tomorrow that I'm going to go and research, it's still hard work, and that's fine because I like it. And, I was really lucky to have some bosses in radio who really just dragged me over the coals and went, "Yeah, okay, you've got enough of it that we're going to keep you here, but you're going to have to learn to stop doing this. And I would go in there every week and emerge. But it's called an air check. It's basically a performance review. They listen to a tape of you and go, this is where you went wrong. This is where you went really wrong. This is where you were terrible. And you just had to suck it up and listen and go, okay, how can I get better? How can I get better? And there's nothing that'll do that except flight miles. So
how did you suddenly discover this level of discipline though?
It had always been there. I put it to, my parents, just having that work ethic of that you see in many people who come to Australia for a new life. Like, "Oh, we're here. This is better than it was. Let's just work super hard and take advantage of it." And I see the same thing in my wife, Audrey, and her family. They came from Fiji and both her parents just worked super, super, super hard because they arrived here with very little and now they've built this incredible life just through hard work. Like, again, the classic, immigrant story. And so, yeah, I just found this thing that I was good at and people were saying, "We think you're good at this." I was like, "Oh, I like that feeling when you tell me I'm good. I like that. I want to work harder for more of that."
So having had all of that anxiety, all of those nerves,
yeah,
what did it mean to you finding this thing?
Well, it was extraordinary because, again, when the mic was on, everything was cool and calm and fine and I was in control. And that's just gave me extraordinary respite. It really did. And that was the same thing when I got onto television, and as the television graduated, you know, from cable TV then to, you know, live network television, and then all the way to live network television in the States. As soon as the camera's on, it was just absolute serenity.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Hamish McDonald on ABC Radio. Subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Osher, the first season of Australian Idol was huge.
Yeah.
What was it like being at the centre of the final show of that first season?
We found out the other day that something like three in four Australians watched that show.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing. And I met someone, I did in Canberra the other day, and someone from the National Film and Sound Archive said, oh, I put that into our system the other day in 4x3, you know, versus the television format at the time. It was extraordinary to be on the front steps of the Opera House at this moment of time of broadcasting where, you know, the internet was around, but it wasn't that great. Smartphones were around, but they weren't that great. And there was just, we just managed to just catch this wave of pop cultural moment. And, you know, anyone that's done extraordinary work, whether it be, you know, the perfect golf swing, the perfect tennis shot, you know, it felt like that. We were such a finely tuned team. I think there must have been easily 120 people that made that show on that final night. And every single one of us was just doing the best work of our lives. We were like a perfectly synchronized stunt driving team that you see at the Ecker, or the Easter show, I think you call it, down here in Sydney. It was just brilliant, you know, and then to be a part of that was just magnificent. And yeah.
On that night, they'd given you a space to get ready in. What was that?
We got ready in the conductor's suite under the Sydney Opera House. There is a suite where the conductor gets ready, essentially a green room, but it has a 9.5 foot long Steinway grand piano in there. And, you know, there is every single chance that on that piano is where Dame Joan would warm up before she would head out, or Pav would warm up before he head out, or Yehudi Menuhin would warm up before he head out. And we were there in that room. It was me and Jimmy just getting ready. It's got this like 250 degree view of the Harbour Bridge, and it's got its own shower. It's like the most extraordinary, extraordinary room in Sydney. It was amazing. And we, you know, you've got that little feed. Like most theatres now have a closed circuit television feed, and it was like, okay, 5 minutes. Okay. I was like, oh my gosh, here we go. It was so exciting.
What did you do with the grand piano?
I sing a song about this in my show. After the show, you know, I think, you know, the thing is that you don't really know what to do after that amount of adrenaline hits your system. And coming down from a gig, is a thing that only people who've been on those big stages. I mean, I think that we had 7,000 or 10,000 people in the forecourt, and we had another 3,000 inside. And the show went, I think we were finally broadcast like 3 hours or something. We were on stage, and it was just humongous amounts of adrenaline. And then, you know, to come down from that, what do you do? What do you search for? I think it's the oldest story in the book, is that you look for something that might, you know, try and keep that high going. You don't have 10,000 people, but you might have a fine white powder in a bag that you can crush up and inhale through your nostrils. The tagline of that fine white powder that you can crush up and inhale through your nostrils is, it'll make you feel like 10,000 people are screaming your name. It doesn't, but you do it anyway. And ultimately, it's a, you know, I say this now as a sober man, it's a hollow feeling, and it's a feeling that doesn't really touch the sides, and it's a feeling that ultimately isolates you. Because I remember walking out into the after party, and, you know, the after party was packed. There must have been like 500 or 600 people there. And I'm in this room of just heaving with people, and I was completely alone because I was, you know, just so totally disconnected emotionally from the situation, you know, being high and, you know, being full of beer, and, you know, also being quite afraid of strangers by that point. it was a very strange feeling to be all alone in this room full of people where people were pushing up against me. I felt, as if I was standing in this room by myself. It's a very weird feeling.
How were you coping with all of the attention and fame?
I think, it's a well-trodden path. Unfortunately, I wish, Hamish, that I could tell you a different story, but it's the same story. You know, there's a very highly acceptable, socially acceptable, usable depressant that, many people reach for in times where they require some sort of quick gear change. It's called alcohol. People have no problem with it. Apparently, when cricketers drink it in commercials that, girls with bikinis and fishing rods appear out of nowhere. Well, that's what I was, sold up in Queensland, at least. That never happened, but I kept drinking just in case it would. Alcohol became the thing that I started to use to manage those feelings of either fear or when things started to get, I find myself getting very, very excited and kind of whirring like a top and unable to slow down. And alcohol was the thing that I reached for in that situation. I'm not the first Australian man to reach for alcohol to manage his own anxiety. Ultimately, it ended up in a pretty sticky place, and I needed, alcohol was no longer my problem. It then became my solution. And then unfortunately the amount that I needed to drink to become to feel anywhere near normal or accepted or calm just became utterly unmanageable. And I could see quite clearly, I believe it was Lao Tzu that said, be careful of the direction that you are heading. You may just end up there. And I could see quite clearly where it was going to end up because I'd read enough autobiographies. I knew what was happening. I knew this is, okay, I know where this ends.
I knew this very predictable story.
I wish that I could say I was some sort of special snowflake, but it's the oldest story in the book, and it's been written 100 times and we have seen it end 101. We know exactly how it ends.
Why couldn't you stop, given you could see that?
You saying that, why don't you just stop having a drink, is you saying that with your brain, okay? You don't have what I have. I would explain it to you like this. You're aware of what happens if you have a peanut allergy, right, Hamish? That if you were to eat or even just a sliver or a trace, you would have an allergic reaction that changes your body. If you're anaphylactic, your throat will start to close over. You may have a very severe reaction. You may actually die. I started to develop, if I hadn't already had it already, an allergic reaction to alcohol. Like the tiniest little sip of it would trigger an allergic reaction in my body that I was no longer able to make clear decisions. I was no longer able to make decisions that were in alignment with who I felt I was, what I thought was, the right or wrong thing to do when I wasn't drinking, and completely affected my ability to decide how much more I was going to drink. And it didn't matter the amount. Just all I needed was the tiniest little trace amount of it, and that was it. I'd become a different person. And the best way to manage that, like most allergies, is avoidance. And so that's why.
Did it trouble you that this incredible success wasn't making you feel happy?
Yeah, it did actually, because, you read all the books and, you see all the posters, and apparently when you stand up there on stage, everything's supposed to be awesome. But I would, sometimes those, we did 7 of those grand finals. We did 7 nights like that, and they were just, each was bigger than the last. They were massive. And I would walk off stage and I'd just feel absolutely empty. I'd be like, oh, what now? I wasn't able to feel, that was excellent. There was a lot of, internal psychological issues going on around that something, so an achievement of such magnitude wasn't able to touch the sides is a problem. And I have since had to work on that quite significantly with my various doctors. But at the time I was just like, why isn't this doing it? Why? I know, I'll go to America. That'll make it better. And then I chased it there. And that was probably a part of the thing that made me work so hard to chase bigger and bigger opportunities at work was I've just got to get that feeling that I did it. I've got to get that feeling that I did it. And even though when I did finally get to, I think I'm still the only Australian to have ever hosted live network primetime TV in the States on CBS. It was 10 million people live coast to coast. It was just incredible. Like on camera, absolute serenity, absolute serenity. But by then I'd stopped drinking. So I was able to, I'd started to get sober. So I was able to feel a sense of worthiness around that gig. But up to that, it was always just empty. But it made me, I worked so hard to try and get that feeling, but it was never there.
During that time, how do you think people around you found it working with you?
I knew I was, sometimes it could be okay. Sometimes it could be quite difficult. particularly when I was starting to really fall into the social phobia. I was diagnosed with social phobia in 2005.
What's that?
Social phobia is you're afraid of people. You're afraid of people. You don't like strangers. Don't want to talk to strangers. Don't want to have strangers look at you. Don't want them to say anything to you. Even Audrey the other day, she picked it up. She goes, because we were on holiday and we were on holiday in a place where there's quite a number of Australians. She goes, you know what's interesting? Is that when you go and talk to someone, when you initiate the contact, you're totally fine with it. But if someone comes up to you, you freak out. Like, you know, they're going to touch you with a handful of acid. Oh, right. That's really helped me a lot understand that. So, you know, I still deal with it. So I was diagnosed in 2005 and I thought alcohol was going to make that better. It didn't. But I ended up going on meds for that about 2007. So, you know, around trying to manage that by self-medicating was not a very good idea. And I can't imagine that, there were some days where I was probably not great to work with.
Over time, some of these challenges really grew for you and you found yourself in some pretty dark places. How dark?
Well, you did the trigger warning at the start, but I should say that, if anything that, we talk about here makes you feel a bit uncomfortable, please go talk to your GP or give Lifeline a call. But it got to the point where about 5 years ago, actually, it was February 21st, 2014, 5 years ago, my brain just kind of fractured into this prism of just doom, and I couldn't see or perceive anything, hear, taste, touch, smell, anything that didn't filter through this prism of horror. And I started experiencing paranoid delusions, which is I believe it's a form of psychosis, and it was very, very, very troubling. I was seeing things, I was seeing visions, and
what
stuff
sort
like
of
that.
Thing?
Like I would see very, very clearly. Like I had this, basically my head wanted me to believe that the full, complete, cataclysmic projections of climate change were happening today, that the seas were going to rise 15 metres today. And, every single thing around me was a sign that was going to happen. My brain was trying to tie everything back into it. And so I'd be running and I'd just get along. I was living in Venice Beach at the time and I was running along the Venice Beach boardwalk to try and clear my head. And instead all I see is, waves crashing into the houses at the front there. And I see the palm trees are now, like a water lily floating on the surface of the new ocean, and like everywhere, it was clear as day. And a couple of weeks later, it went on for a long time. I was in London and I'm running through Kensington Gardens, trying to make my head feel better. And I'm, the trees, it was winter, but the trees still had a few leaves on them. But when I looked at them, they were like the trees you see in the cenotes in Mexico, like just dead underwater trees. And I'm running along the surface of the new floor of the ocean. And it was really, really hard to deal with because there's other people out there walking their dogs and having a great time.
And you're jogging along Venice Beach thinking all of this.
Yeah. And it was as real as you were sitting in front of me. And then it would flick out again and I'd be like, oh, that's really bad. And then it would come back and it would come and go. And it was very, very, very troubling to know that something was so wrong with my head because I didn't want it to be wrong. I didn't want to have this. I didn't want to go on like that. But I didn't know if it was ever going to feel better. And eventually a really great idea popped into my head about, and it was very, very painful. I was very, very worried because it caused physical pain as well, and great physical pain that was not leaving me, and it was just swirling and swirling and swirling. And it went on for days and days and days and days. And then, about 2 weeks in, this idea popped into my head of like, I know a really great way to make all this stop. And that's when the suicidal ideation started. And it's very tough to deal with that when your brain is trying to tell you, here's a really easy way out, man. Here's a way to make all this pain stop. It's super simple. Here's how you do it. Like, I can't do that. It comes to you. It doesn't come to you as a frightening thing. It didn't come to me as a frightening thing. It didn't come to me like, oh, I've got to break up with this person. I've got to make this tough phone call to break up, or I've got to quit my job. I'm going to, you feel a bit of, was like, oh, it's going to be so good when that happens. And when that hit my head, then I knew, oh man, I'm in a lot of trouble. Because if my brain's trying to tell me that that's a good idea, I know that's not a good idea. I know guys it's happened to. I need help. I need help fast. And so, I started Skyping and FaceTiming people all over the world because I was in Israel at the time shooting a TV pilot. And I was just basically Skyping people and trying to, because I knew enough from when I'd gotten sober that when you're in a tough time, just pick up the phone. Just don't pick up a drink, pick up the phone. And so I knew, okay, I just have to pick up a phone because my brain's telling me this is a good idea. So I know it's not a good idea, but I need to talk to someone to try and can I get a handle on reality here. And so I spoke to both my brothers for hours. And in fact, I told this story on stage the other night, and one of my brothers was there, and he turned to Audrey, my wife, and said, oh, I remember that phone call. I remember it because it was so weird. He was so scared. And, you know, it was 4 a.m. or something where I was. And I just spoke to people all day until I got a call back from my doctor in Sydney who told me I should, you know, probably go to the emergency department, but be careful because you're in a foreign country. They'll probably commit you. So I clearly couldn't do that. I've got a TV pilot to shoot that day. I can't go to hospital. So luckily when I got to the gig, you know, when the camera was on, it was okay again. But then I ended up going to see a bunch of doctors when I got back to Los Angeles, and it took quite a while. It took many different combinations of medication, and I ended up on 2 different kinds of antipsychotics and an SSRI and an aminoketone. It was basically a psychiatry talk to just give him everything. And it was like the fire retardant foam blanket that you see. You know, sometimes you'll see an aeroplane on the news and they just see the wing of it sticking out because the whole thing just is a ball of fire retardant foam. That's basically what it felt like. Just give him everything until he stabilizes. And so I was on everything for a while. And it took a lot of work because, like, the meds just don't make it all stop. The meds just are basically the knee brace that you get if you ever do your ACL or you hurt yourself, that, or like the strapping tape that your physio gives you, and then you have to do the exercises to make the muscle stronger. So similarly, the meds just, they give you the support that is required to do the work. And the work's hard. You don't want to do the work. Exposure therapy sucks. But that's the way out. For me, that was the way out.
Do you know how many doctors you've seen, how many different medications you've tried?
Lots and lots, but that's okay because it's not, you know, there's what we're sitting here in the ABC and I can see 4 or 5 people. If 4 or 5 different people, different body weights, different, you know, histories, whatever, if we have a headache, we've probably got the choice of 1 or 2 different medications, paracetamol or ibuprofen, all right? And we'll probably get a similar effect, all right? However, if 4 or 5 of us present to a doctor with symptoms that I was describing, I've got a different trauma history, you've got a different history, you've got a different history. You know, it's not the same for everybody. So you've got to keep trying. And so it's the same with doctors. They just have to keep trying. And it's self-reported too. How are you feeling this week? So they're trying to get a straight answer about how someone's feeling out of someone who might not have a clear handle on how they're feeling. It's very tricky stuff. But thankfully, I was very lucky that I had actually 2 psychiatrists who were willing to question their initial hypotheses, which allowed them to go, okay, well, maybe we'll try a different combination here. Maybe we'll try something else. And it took a long time. It took a long, long, long time and a lot of work. And about just over a year ago, I managed to get off all the meds. So I'm off meds at the moment, but Hamish, it's like I would go back on them tomorrow if I needed to. If I felt that, you know, and it's been a tough couple of weeks. I'm sure like anyone that, I mean, we just, Audrey and I just, you know, I've known for a couple months now, but Audrey and I are expecting a baby and I'm sure, well, thank you, mate. But I'm sure like anyone who's suddenly expecting a baby, it can be a trigger for a relapse. And so I'm on high alert, you know, not only with my drinking, but also with my mental health, just to be, okay, I've got to really be careful here for the signs and signals because, you know, the problem sometimes, and this is certainly in my case, the problem with me experiencing a period of mental ill health is that I might not realize that I'm experiencing a period of mental ill health because it all, as far as I'm concerned, everything's real and normal. Right. So I'm constantly having, before we went on air, I had a little check-in with you. It's like, can you just tell me, you know, when you think about this stuff, what do you think? I was just, you know, just double checking something that I thought of downstairs. And so I check in with my wife and I check in with my mentor and I check in with my doctors. I see my psychiatrist quite often, about every 6 weeks or so, just to double check, just to make sure. But that's what I've got, you know, that's where I am.
It's such an amazing thing to know that you and Audrey are going to have a child. What is it that you fear?
Well, I think it's like, what does anyone fear, you know? But I'll never forget.
You're going to be a great dad.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you. I'd like to think I do my best already. I have a stepdaughter that I've been in that role. I've been doing that job for 5 years now. I'd like to think I'd do it as well as I possibly can. So I've got a bit of practice, but only with 10 plus. So I don't have any practice with the first 10 years. So we'll see. By the time we get to 10 with this one, I'll be like, I've been here before. I think, what does anybody fear? You know, you suddenly realize the scope of like, oh, we're going to bring a life into this world. Oh, my God. But you've got to remember that 12 million people drove home safely in Australia yesterday, but only the 3 car crashes made the news. So just remember that even though you're watching the news and it's, you know, doom and gloom, it's like, well, is that really the actual truth? And I remember my mum saying, because she spotted it in me when I first met Audrey, she spotted that I was afraid to have a kid. And she goes, when we were on the road, when we were fleeing Lithuania, people were starting families all around us. She's like, life goes on. People had no problem with it. I'm sure you've seen it too, Hamish. I'm sure you've seen it in war zones. People just go, okay, so this is happening, but it's not going to happen forever. Let's do this and see if we can't make the world a better place.
A disclosure, I know Audrey, your wife, as well. She's also done my makeup. What's she done to you as a human? You seem so much happier.
You don't need it, and you can get this, you know, from your community, but Audrey gave me someone to live for. She was the first person to kind of get through all that weird delusion and paranoia that was just obscuring my ability to appreciate reality. And she was the first person to pierce that veil. And I know enough that my thinking, when it's obscured and when it's, you know, fractured, isn't healthy. So I know enough to trust another person's thoughts and go, even though my brain's telling me all these things, I trust that person enough that what they tell me to do will be the right thing to do. And so, and you know what? It is. And everything's better when I just listen to my wife.
Good advice for life. Osher Ginsberg, thank you.
It's been a complete honor, man. Thank you.
Osher Ginsberg's book is called Back After the Break. And if hearing Osher's story today has raised any issues for you, Lifeline is there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. 13 11 14. The number is 13 11 14. We'll put those details on our website, and this Conversations will be there shortly too. abc.net.au/conversations.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.